Donc c'est 11h30, on a terminé le panel dans une situation d'inconfort. Mais peut-être que maintenant on retrouve un peu de confort ou de confiance dans les capacités du système international. It's time to start, even if it's time for the presentation of Samantha Besson and of José Luis Martí of the Pompeu Fabra University. So it will be only José Luis who will speak. Apparently, both worked on this paper.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you to Samantha for organizing this fabulous conference, because this is the last paper and I hope we will not ruin it. I think we can already say that it's fabulous. So it's always a pleasure to be in anything that Samantha organizes, and I've been collaborating with her for a long, long time now. And it's always a lot of fun, but especially we were actually talking about this during the break. She manages always to create a very special atmosphere, and I think that we have all enjoyed this atmosphere yesterday and today. So we will try to present the paper, which is, as you may have seen, it's actually by far the longest paper in the conference. The only excuse, but we don't have any excuse actually, but since she is the organizer, I think that nobody will blame us. But in any case, it's of course impossible to try to give you a complete summary of all what we try to develop in the paper, which in any case, it will have to be cut down dramatically for the publication. So basically I will try to go to the main ideas there, we have divided the presentation into, I will present the paper, and then we will try to answer your questions together. But I will try to focus on those parts that I think might be of more interest. And I want to start by telling you, maybe that's important to understand the background and why the paper became so long. The reason is that this is part of a longer project that we have been already working on for a few years, where the final end or one of the final ends might be the publication of a book. So we published a first paper together on this topic in 2018 called Legitimate Actors of International Lawmaking, and then a second paper, more recent paper, on the rise of global cities, also as the democratic representatives in international lawmaking. And this would be our third paper, where we focus in IOs and the role of state consent in IOs. But of course, we bring part of the framework that we tried to develop in the previous papers, and this complicates a little bit our argument in the paper, because we don't want to take much distance from the general framework that we are adopting. That's the main reason why the paper took so long, but as I said, we will try to work to reduce it substantially. So I will focus basically I will try to make sure that you get a good idea of the claims that we try to make in the paper. So I will spend some time in section one, even if that might go in detriment of sections two, three, and four, which are basically the development of our argument. I will try to be sketchy there, especially I will skip several parts. And then I will try to make sure that I still have some time for section five, which is probably the core of the argument, especially in regard to what we are discussing these days. So the claims in the paper, so we start by noticing two trends, probably, I hope that this will not be controversial, two trends that we can identify, maybe among many others, but these are two trends that we might identify in the current situation of IOs. One, you know, everybody knows, we've been discussing this for years and years now, is the rise of non-state actors. They are becoming much more powerful, they have more influence, they can have more visibility in several contexts. And by non-state actors, as you know, we speak of both public and private actors. Perhaps part of the literature has focused on private actors, But actually, we have seen in several papers these days that the role of other public but non-state actors is also prominent and also deserves our attention. And as we try to argue in the paper, we have a special interest or a special reason to focus on them. And at the same time, I think we can claim fairly that the role of states is somehow declining in the governance of international organizations. There might be many reasons for that. There might be many instances of that, many examples. And there might be also many reasons of why this is happening. You know, one of the obvious reasons is that as long as states have traditionally were considered like the fundamental stakeholders or the fundamental basis of the functioning of international organizations and the fundamental constituents, let's say, of international organizations, all the problems that came associated with the state consent, especially if we understand it in a very strong sense, as we will try to clarify later, came to paralyze certain functions of certain operations of IOs. And then one easy way of trying not to get caught by this problem is actually circumventing the role of the states. This might be one reason, among many others, we're not trying to make here a full description. So how can we assess these two trends? Then regarding the first one, what we basically try to say in the paper is, for the reasons I will try to explain briefly in a second, I think the first one is something that should be celebrated in general. So there might be instances in which it might be a bad idea actually to give more power to non-state actors, but in general, for the reasons I will explain, we should celebrate this. And you know, let me just anticipate the main reason actually by which we should celebrate this is that the functioning of IOs has many shortcomings, especially of democratic legitimacy, as we will say. So the emergence and the participation of non-state actors might be of fundamental help to try to compensate or remedy or alleviate some of these shortcomings. The claim that we try to make in the paper, and this is in accordance to the framework that we developed previously in our previous papers, is an idea that we call the multiple representation and multiple sovereignty system. Actually, the idea of sovereignty has been added. It was always there in the previous papers, but we have tried to develop it a little bit farther in this paper, even if this might fall apart in the final version of the paper. But the kind of ideal that we try to defend in the paper is this idea that we call the multi-public system of multiple representation and sovereignty, and that we have defended, as I said before, in previous works. Regarding the second trend, what we have to say regarding the second trend is two things. One is, well, the decline of the role of states, if what we mean by that is that there is this long term, actually this is not new at all, there's linked this long term to try to deprive states from their veto powers. That would be the strongest sense in which they might exercise consent, the principle of state consent. If there is this long term trend to try to deprive states from having these veto powers, or even a little bit weaker, refusal powers, not to enter into schemes that they don't accept, which is not so strong as having veto power, preventing others from getting their own agreements, but it's still quite strong. So these, if our diagnose that these two strong understandings of the role of state consent has been one of the main reasons why international organizations may have tried to circumvent the participation of states, then we think it's positive that international organizations are trying to get independent, with some caveats that I will try to explain in the argument. But second, and for the reasons that this might actually make international organizations, taking some power out from the hands of the state might make them actually more legitimate and much more efficient. However, I think that we think that this decline of the role of states might come with a cost, and this cost might be also a cost in terms of democratic legitimacy, because the states, in the end, they, or some of them at least, they are the legitimate representatives of the peoples. And then if you if international organizations evolve in such a way that they get independent from the possibility of the states to give their consent to the kind of decisions they make or the law they make, etc., we think that this comes also with a cost. So we have a more nuanced argument about this. The ideas, I will skip this and we'll come back to the details later. And as I said, I will try to fit with the time that we are given. So just a few last clarificatory remarks. The paper, this chapter, is a chapter that is based on a normative philosophy of international law. So we try to make a normative argument. However, this is, just to use Fuad's expression of yesterday, it aspires to be a sociologically informed normative political philosophy, especially in the sense that what we try to do is what philosophers, political philosophers and moral philosophers called non-ideal theory. So basically what we try to say is there are many ideals, different ideals of how the international order should work and how international organizations should be organized. There are many of them. But for most of them, there are certain values that are central. We try to keep those values as the core of our argument. And then we try to show that from those values, you can see that there are many shortcomings in the system that need some kind of remedy or solution. And these are the things that we are interested in finding, which are the right remedies or solutions that might bring us actually to propose a particular way of reinstituting international organizations. And we do it out of the assumption that international organizations are actually not doing very well. We might disagree with that. So you might think that they are not, I guess that nobody would say that they are perfect, but you might have a more optimistic view of what international organizations are doing and achieving, or a more pessimistic one. We are on the pessimistic side of this thing. And then we think that they are proving to be highly ineffective, and they're, you know, the examples are many, right? From climate change to the pandemic and many others. So they are not doing very well in terms of the efficiency in delivering the functions for which they were created. At the same time, we think that they are doing poorly in terms of their democratic legitimacy. Now, so these are the main claims. Let me go to the arguments, even if I will skip some parts, but let me go to the arguments that we provide in the paper. So we start with the principles of democratic legitimacy. Here, I want to clarify, we are interested in normative legitimacy, not descriptive or sociological legitimacy. So it's not how the people perceive the institutions, but how they should be in order to be morally acceptable or normatively acceptable. That's what we are interested in. And we are interested in input legitimacy, not in output legitimacy. This is nothing, we have nothing to say against descriptive legitimacy and output legitimacy. These are just, as we see them, these are just different questions. And the question about how outputs should be in order to consider them acceptable, that's super interesting, but that's not our question. So our question is how we should design the international organizations to make them normatively acceptable. And by that, we basically mean input legitimacy, which is typically associated with this very traditional understanding of the idea of political legitimacy that comes to associate it with the right to rule, even if in a different perspective to the one that David was expressing yesterday. Basically, because he was assuming, and it's very common in political philosophy, to assume that those who have the right to rule, when they rule, they create an obligation, a duty to obey. We are not assuming that. And for that reason, we think that what we say is fully compatible with what David was saying. It's just a different question. Our question is who has the right to rule and how this right to rule should be exerted to be made normatively accepted. Whether this correlates to a duty to obey or not, that's a separate question. And then it's not very original. We are not trying to make any original statement here. What we basically, our intention here was to cover a wide field of intuitions of many democratic theorists and political philosophers of international law who have been working on the international legitimacy. Not all of them have called it explicitly democratic legitimacy, and we know that this idea that international legitimacy might be approached as democratic legitimacy, that is controversial, and many people think that democracy is simply a different thing that only works for states, but we should forget about it when we care about international organizations. We are aware of that discussion. We can come back to this in the Q&A, but we still think that part of the discussion, whether democracy really applies or not to the international sphere, is driven by a confusion. And the confusion is that many people, when they talk about democracy, they seem to presuppose that democracy always comes with certain institutions. They have an institutional account of democracy. So they say you cannot have a democracy if you don't have a parliament with free periodic elections. We are very far from having one at the international sphere, so forget about international democracy. But that's only one way of looking at democracy. There's another way of looking at democracy, which is looking at the principles or values that sustain those institutions. And those values might be instantiated differently in different contexts. In the domestic context, they might require having a parliament with free periodic elections. In the international sphere, they might require different things. So try to forget about the word democratic here. If it bothers you, I think you can follow the argument even if you don't take this as a democratic theory, even if we are interested in developing a democratic theory. But the important thing is the values. And what we propose, and again, we're not trying to be original, is that these are four values that you can find very widespread in the literature. The principle of ultimate effective popular control, which is normally one way of explaining the value of self-government, which is of course very prevalent. We particularly like the version of Philip Pettit, how he has explained the importance of this idea of ultimate control. And this is important because this shows that what is at stake, what is really fundamental if you want to secure self-government, is not that people necessarily, that people are able to elect their representatives in a parliament. That's only one way of instantiating the principle. But what is really important is that whatever institutional framework you have, this framework and the decisions that the framework, the system generates, they are under the ultimate effective control of the people. If you don't have that, then of course you don't have self-government. So the challenge for the international sphere would be, let's try to find ways in which people, the peoples of the world, they can find some mechanisms to have the international organizations and the things they do and decide under their ultimate control. And for that challenge, of course, the states are key. And the other three principles, very quickly, there are the principle of political equality. We will come back to this in other sections of the paper. The principle of deliberative contestability, and then a substantive principle of human rights protection. But again, nothing of this is very original. So, first of all, we try to defend the principle of state consent. So we are convinced that there are many reasons to try to defend the role of states in the governance of international organizations and in international lawmaking, at least of some states, and at least in some circumstances. But if those conditions are met, then we think that there is a value in that. And the main reason is that, you know, states have a special role in representing the peoples, that so far we haven't found any better way of representing the peoples of the world than through their state governments. We here use some quotes by Tom Cristiano, but again, it's not about Cristiano. Pretty many people who have been participating in this discussion would agree on these basic ideas, that states have these values. Let me quote Cristiano just as an example, but states are still by far the most effective systems for making power accountable to persons. And second, these states are in a position to represent their members to the larger community. For at least these two reasons and a few others that we try to specify in the paper, we think that the role of states should be central. Despite this, and as I anticipated, there are many shortcomings. In the paper, we identify six. We just stick, we restrain our argument to see how the first two of the four principles of legitimacy apply to the role of states in IOS or in international lawmaking. We identify six shortcomings or deficits. In a previous work, we had identified nine, and probably the list might be longer. We welcome if you want to have any suggestion of how to make it even longer. Even if we don't need actually more arguments to make the basic claim. So, but just let me name a couple of them. So it's obvious, and we have been discussing this in several papers. I'm happy to see that there are many bridges across papers. That one problem is that some states are not democratic. So how can we accept the idea that the government of North Korea represents legitimately the people of North Korea before any international organization or before the international community? How can we accept that fiction? That is very hard to accept. And that doesn't mean necessarily that then the government of North Korea should be expelled from international organizations. That doesn't follow. All what we are saying is we have a problem there. Some people, you know, according to most rankings, one half of the countries of the states in the world don't count as sufficiently democratic. So that means, and in demographics, it's more or less the same account. More than one half actually live under non-democratic states. Even if we restrict the argument to those that are clearly not democratic, full-blown authoritarian, that means a lot of people. And these people are not well represented in the international sphere or in IOs. But even for those countries that are democratic, there are problems of limited accountability of the governments. Basically, I mean, many reasons might justify this, but one of them is that what governments do in their international affairs, even if this changes from one country to another, but these are not very salient issues in the political debate during political campaigns, and the people of the country don't have many mechanisms, actually, to hold their own governments accountable for what they have done internationally. And of course, there are imbalances of power. States, we have been discussing this also these days, states that have much more control in international organizations, we know that. That, of course, is not acceptable in terms of democratic legitimacy. There are disproportions in demography, and we have also heard some arguments pointing this out and other arguments. So there are all these shortcomings. And basically what we propose, this is part of our framework, we propose that we should design, first of all, we should assume that there are these shortcomings and that they need to be fixed or counterbalanced. So when we, in the project of reinstituting IOs, if you think that some particular IO should be rethought, reconceptualized, in the process of reinstituting IOs, there are certain things that we should keep in mind. If we want those IOs to be democratically legitimate or more democratically legitimate, I didn't say it in the interest of time, but we think that normative legitimacy comes in degrees. It's a scalar thing. It's not an all or nothing. So the project, the challenge here would be how to make IOs more legitimate. And then here we have some proposals. And so if that is the framework and the challenge that we try to address, our solution depends, and I don't have much time to go to the details, but our solution depends on the opportunity of maximizing the representation of those who are unrepresented or insufficiently well represented in the international system. And it's in that perspective that the rise of non-state actors is especially something to celebrate, at least potentially, right? So non-state actors have the potential to represent people who are now currently unrepresented or underrepresented. First, private actors, they are not representative on some accounts of political representation because they have not been elected, but there are theories of representation, like the representation claim theory, developed by Sauert and many other people have endorsed it, that might provide an explanation of why we might see them as representative in a different sense. Perhaps not a perfect sense, perhaps not ideal, not an ideal instance of representation, but still something that might help us with the problem we have, which is a problem of serious, systematic representation deficit. Second, there's a special consideration to be paid here to public non-state actors. And here we try, basically through after our paper on cities, we try to put an emphasis here. This applies both to supranational and subnational public non-state institutions. The problem with supranational ones is that they are not democratic either, or they are only democratic. They might be only indirectly democratic to some extent with a lot of caveats, but normally we wouldn't extend the notion of democratic legitimacy as they are because of the problem of shortcomings, among others. But at the level of subnational public institutions, we think there's a lot of potential. And Duncan mentioned yesterday, it was a cyber security instrument that was signed. Where is Duncan? He's left. No, oh, yes, yeah. You mentioned, thank you. You mentioned yesterday that instrument. There are plenty of examples in which non-state actors might participate, and that was one in which you said even scholars signed it, so even very private actors did it. There is a differential participation of those non-state public actors that are democratically elected, like typically the case of mayors. I think there's an argument to be made there. So just to be clear, we don't say that non-state actors should replace the states, of course, very far from that. Actually, we, as I said, we try to defend some key role for states. But we think that these non-state actors can play a very important complementary role in international lawmaking and in the governance of international organizations. I will skip all the part that has to do with sovereignty. If you have read the paper, we are happy to come back to this later, even if it fits nicely with some other remarks that have been presented previously. We basically try to endorse a different notion of sovereignty, according to which there is no contradiction in saying that cities might be granted or recognized some sovereignty when they act internationally. We might come back then to that in the discussion, but let me just skip it. And let me just mention these examples. So you may remember that when the US under the Trump administration withdrew from the Paris Agreement, there was this movement of cities in the US trying to say, okay, the US federal government is going out, but then we will get in back. We will bring back our cities to the agreement. We will sign it or endorse it or whatever. And that will be a way of supporting the agreement and be part of it. That is a real example. But then something that was about to happen, and I think in my opinion, and in our opinion, fortunately didn't happen in the end, but Trump also threatened, and I think as far as I know, the American Congress initiated the process to withdraw from the WHO after the pandemic in 2020. So you might have seen, because in the first case, you don't have an international organization, but in the second one, we are talking about the WHO, which is the main example we use along the paper. And you might have expected something similar to what happened in 2020 regarding the Paris Agreement, but in relation to the WHO. Had United States effectively withdrawn from the WHO, maybe some cities would have actually asked to keep some kind of relationship with the international organization. And then we need to explain, if we think that is a good idea, we need to explain which role we are happy to attribute to them, on which basis we are happy to host them or to allow them to participate in decision makings, procedures, and so on. Let me just skip the third case. Finally, in my last 3 minutes, four, let me go to the main core. Sorry to be now in a hassle, but let me go to the final section of the paper. So in the paper, we start this final section by saying clearly that we believe that international organizations must have a crucial role in international lawmaking. There's also this other view that says they are also, in a way, falling apart because of many reasons. The rise of soft law, the rise of private arrangements or hybrid arrangements or institutions. There is some kind of narrative that might say that international organizations are, their power is also declining. We believe that if that is true, that is bad news, and we should actually, we have many reasons. We mentioned three, I cannot go into the details, but we give reasons actually to say they are central actors of international lawmaking and they should keep being central, even if this is compatible with the discussion with Fernando about whether they should be regarded as the main actors or not, or they should have some kind of consent rights. So it's true that they also suffer from their own drawbacks, and we have been discussing these days, so let me just skip this. But we, in any case, propose that we should reinstitute those international organizations heavily to try to adjust them to the principles of democratic legitimacy. And in that context, we think that the principle of state consent is crucial. An adequate reconceptualization of the principle of state consent is crucial. We hope that we will benefit from the discussions yesterday, especially about the concept of state consent, and I think this is one of the things we have to make more nuanced. But let me present what we have done so far. So what we try to do in the paper is to say, okay, the principle of state consent traditionally, historically, has been understood in a very strong sense. State consent here understood as acceptance or agreement, as it has been said these days, but it has been associated with a very strong formal notion of a state consent, which basically comes associated either with veto powers in some cases or with refusal powers. These are the two strongest versions of a state consent. In the paper, we want to say, if, as I anticipated before, if there is a decline of this strongest version of a state consent in IOs today, That is probably good news. Even if we want to make room to save, perhaps not veto powers, because this is really problematic in terms of political equality and so on, but maybe there is some argument to defend some kind of refusal powers, at least in a few moments that are critical to the functioning of IOs. For instance, and more especially, in the foundational moment of IOs, when IOs are instituted in the first place, maybe also in the design of the main processes, procedures of the IO, and finally, in one that it's not here in the list, but it's also important, which is in having exit rights. So we think that if there is a place in which you can still defend a strong notion of a state consent and the status refusal powers, it's in these moments. We think that in a general principle, states should not be forced to join IOs if they don't want. And second, states should be able to leave those IOs, exit those IOs if they want. These are two very important moments that, for which we think we are happy to accommodate some notion, some strong sense of state consent, despite the problems that this might cause, and it's, of course, a complex issue. Other than that, we think that states should have other ways of getting involved in decision-making, in ordinary decision-making, and actually we want to make the argument that they should be more involved than they have been so far, especially democratic states. We think that because, as I anticipated earlier, we are convinced that IOs have these shortcomings of democratic legitimacy, that the peoples of the world don't have sufficient means to hold those IOs under control, despite the fact, we know it, that these IOs make important decisions that have great effects on the lives of peoples. So they should have means to hold these IOs in control, other than having the right to exit, because this is like the last resort that you can have. So take the example of the US and the WHO. And so let's assume that Trump was right in being upset in the way in which the WHO was making certain decisions. Let's assume that for a moment. He was right in being upset. If the only way that you have to try to resist the imposition of certain rules or certain decisions that you think that they are not good for you or for the world, if the only way that you have to resist that is by getting out from the international organization, we think that is clearly a too high cost, which makes it very difficult to exert. Only crazy guys like Trump would do it in situations like a pandemic, the worst situation for the WHO in its entire history. So we think that other than these foundational moments or this last resort mechanism, there's a leeway, a plenty of room for improving the involvement of a state in the ordinary functioning and governance of IOs in terms of what we call state participation. And this is, and I will stop with that, this is what brings us, there's another nuanced argument that I don't have time to develop here, but it's in the paper, and if you want to discuss it, we are happy to do it, in which we propose to start to go from state participation actually to public participation, to the participation of publics. But the main twist or the main step in our argument is that in this new reconceptualization of a state consent, there is room to preserve some strong formal notion of a state consent as refusal powers. But basically, we advocate we should understand the idea of a state consent in a more flexible way, understood as public participation, in which once you accept this wider notion of a state consent as public participation, then all of a sudden, you can find very nuanced and interesting ways in which you can design decision-making procedures in such a way in which states can interact with non-state actors, especially public non-state actors, but also, why not, private non-state actors that might have an important role and an important contribution to democratic decision-making. And this opens a lot of discussions that, of course, we don't touch even in the paper about how to do it in practice. This can only be approached on a state, on a case-by-case basis. But we are happy to discuss later in the discussion. I'll stop here. And sorry, because I didn't commit. I didn't fit with the schedule, and so I failed. Thank you.